All right, so today's seminar is given by Sue Jorger, as I mentioned, who is the Puget Sound Soundkeeper with the Puget Sound Soundkeeper Alliance, and she's the executive director of that. She has a BA in biology from Mills College, Master of Science in Forest Management from here, University of Washington. She worked for the timber industry for 13 years for the Oregon Department of Forestry, Associated Oregon Loggers, and the Southern Oregon Timber Industries Association. Then she moved back to Seattle, worked with Evergreen Partnership, which is a nonprofit trade association, and then worked with the Center for Streamside Studies, which is the precursor to this water center, and then the Northwest Fisheries Science Center, and then became a Coast Guard licensed captain and taught sailing, and in 1999 became a Puget Sound teacher. Now she's executive director, lives on a sailboat, and just took up surfing. So, tell us about on the water every week, protecting Puget Sound every day.
Actually, I was going to talk about my surfing adventures in Westport, but I wanted to tell you a little bit about our organization today, and mostly it's just a slideshow of what we actually see when we're out on the water and out and about on Puget Sound. The mission of the Puget Sound Keeper Alliance is to protect Puget Sound by tracking down and stopping illegal sources of pollution. And to do this, we monitor Puget Sound by boat. We enforce the Clean Water Act. People are always asking me if I'm an attorney. I'm not, but I spend an awful lot of time with attorneys. We spend time in endless stakeholder and regulated community meetings working on water quality issues, and we also work with people who want to do the right things, people and businesses, to create partnerships to solve problems. We're also a member of the International Waterkeeper Alliance. It's just a group of us recently headed by Robert Kennedy Jr. It was a movement that was started on the Hudson River quite a number of years ago. We were the sixth licensed group back in 1990, and now we have over 180 waterkeepers on waterways around the world, including recently the Amazon River and the Ganga or Ganges River in India. I had a chance to meet one of the Russian keepers who works on a number of Russian rivers, and their biggest issue there is radioactive water in their rivers. So that's a big thing. To be a waterkeeper, you must have a full-time sound keeper or lake keeper or bay keeper or river keeper or stream keeper or, you get the idea, channel keeper. And you have to have a boat to patrol your waters. You must be willing to enforce the Clean Water Act using the citizen lawsuit provision. And this is one of our sound keeper boats. We've had a number over the years that we lease. Also in in Puget Sound, we have another keeper, Wendy Stephenson, who's on the right there, who's out of Bellingham, works for Resources, and she's the North Sound bay keeper. Probably all of you know that Puget Sound is in trouble. This is a picture of Schulschel Marina in Puget Sound looking south towards West Point. And according to the Puget Sound Action Team, State of the Sound report in 2007, the health of Puget Sound is troubling. I don't think that's news to anybody. But 43 species, including orcas, salmon, groundfish, pinnow, abalone, and marine birds like this blue heron from my dock, are threatened or endangered with extinction. That's on the state list. Many of these reasons for the decline are untreated stormwater runoff, ongoing toxic contamination from wastewater, there's historic contamination of sediments, nutrients and pathogens from humans and animal waste, habitat fragmentation destruction, and climate change. Just a little bit of law. How is pollution regulated in Puget Sound? We basically use the Federal Clean Water Act to protect Puget Sound. This was passed in the Nixon administration back in the 70s, and the goal of the Clean Water Act was to maintain the chemical, physical, and biological integrity of the nation's waters. And the hope was to achieve that, to eliminate the discharge of pollutants to the nation's waters by 1985. So a very ambitious goal, which we are far away from achieving. They also said that it was the national policy to prohibit the discharge of toxic pollutants in toxic amounts. Now, the most brilliant thing about the Clean Water Act, and remember this was passed during the Nixon administration, was that it has a citizen lawsuit provision. This allows citizens to take action, to sue the EPA or the Department of Ecology or any polluter that is violating the Clean Water Act. Absolutely brilliant for its time. And we use that citizen lawsuit provision to protect water. In Washington State, the EPA has delegated its authority to implement the Clean Water Act to the Department of Ecology. And basically, this is real simple. In order to discharge pollutants into Puget Sound, you have to have a pollution discharge permit. There are two types of permits. There's individual permits. That's for like a factory, like a pulp and paper mill, like Kimberly-Clark up in Everett, or it's like a sewage treatment plant like Metro down at West Point. There are approximately 900 point source pollution discharge permits around Puget Sound. We monitor the implementation of all of those. The second set of permits are stormwater permits, and these are they're basically 8 permits that cover stormwater discharges around Puget Sound, and there's about 5,000 facilities that are covered under this stormwater permit. Basically, what the Puget Sound Keeper Alliance does is we monitor the implementation of the Clean Water Act through records reviews. Every facility that has a permit has to monitor the quality of the water coming off their site, so we review those records, and they have to follow certain limits or benchmarks. We appeal permits that we don't like if they're not restrictive enough. We can appeal the permits that Department of Ecology has written. And we also sue permit violators when ecology fails to act. Of course, today in Puget Sound, stormwater runoff is the number one source of pollution harming Puget Sound and impairing its waterways. In 2001, our board of directors said there was no other environmental group around town that wanted to take on this rather unglamorous world of stormwater regulation. And given that we're a fairly small organization with 6 employees and about a $450,000 budget, we thought that maybe we could do something for stormwater pollution. Like I said, there's 8 permits that regulate. I mean, the future of Puget Sound basically rests in those four little piles of paper. The permits include, they regulate industrial facilities, construction sites from 1 to 5 acres, sand and gravel operations, boat yards, concentrated animal feeding operations, and large cities and counties, as well as the 18,000 lane miles that the Washington State Department of Transportation manages. The Puget Sound Keeper Alliance has legally challenged all of these permits at least once, and the only one we haven't challenged is the DOT, and that's because they haven't gotten it out on the street. But every time we challenge it, we go to the Pollution Control Hearings Board, and we spend a small fortune, and actually we do have success in making gains for water quality, though it's very incremental and it's very political. I think by far the biggest stormwater challenge is the municipal permits, which regulate stormwater runoff from City of Seattle, Tacoma, King, Pierce, and Snohomish counties. It's incomprehensible, the challenge we face there. This is the mouth of Longfellow Creek, which flows into the Duwamish River, which flows into Elliott Bay, which is off of downtown Seattle. And millions of dollars have been spent on restoring this urban creek. And recently, scientists at the Northwest Fisheries Science Center and Seattle Public Utilities have been documenting the coho salmon running up this creek. And they've documented that somewhere between, depending upon the year, 40 to 90% of the female coho entering Longfellow Creek actually die before they spawn. And they think it's because of the contact with the toxic stormwater, though I think they're still doing a forensic study to figure out you know, is it one specific thing or is it the sort of the soup of chemicals and pollutants in there that are doing it? And coho also are very sensitive species. The pre-spawn mortality rate in a rural creek is about 1%. So this is one of the first studies in Puget Sound that documented that stormwater can kill fish. And I've actually seen, this is not, actually there's a nice video, it's not a nice video, there's a video of coho salmon on the Northwest Fisheries Science Center's webpage that documents what happens to the salmon as they die in the stormwater, and they basically lose their orientation, they end up on their side, their fins are up in the air, and they start gaping and eventually die. And I've actually seen this on our patrols in the Duwamish River where salmon are on the surface swimming in circles. The other stormwater permits we watch over are construction stormwater, sand and gravel stormwater, boatyard stormwater. This is blue bottom paint under a boat that's being sanded and repainted. A bottom paint on boats is very toxic because they use copper and zinc to prevent marine growth. It's fairly effective. But it's also, salmon are very sensitive to low levels of copper. And we also monitor industrial stormwater discharges. So that's sort of what we do with stormwater. The other thing that we do is that we enforce the Clean Water Act. And this is what we do, and we've done probably over 120 times since I've been the keeper, is we've used the citizen lawsuit provision of the Clean Water Act to bring egregious permit violators into compliance with their permits when the Department of Ecology fails to do it. As you can imagine, there's Department of Ecology's budget is determined by the state legislature. So if there's a lot of Department of Ecology enforcement going on, so a lot of the regulated community comes in and cuts their budget. So what we found is virtually in the past decade that ecology just has not had the resources to or the will to enforce the Clean Water Act, so we've really stepped in. In fact, in the last 24 months, we've initiated an unprecedented 68 enforcement actions. And this is our lead legal team. I mean, we have a team of attorneys that are working for us that could make small fortunes working in the private sector, but they're willing to work at nonprofit rates, and I love it that his boat is named Piranha. But anyway, we work with a number of attorneys from Smith & Lowney and Scope Law Firm to do this work. There are many water keepers around the country that wish they actually had attorneys that work on water quality on behalf of citizens groups. And I just want to show you a few sites that we've sued. This is the J. Jack and Son along the Duwamish River. They're we sued them because of low pH and suspended solids. This is Certainty. They're a wallboard manufacturer. There's some of those crumpled up, unused wallboard, which is stored outside. Most of that stormwater is collected, but we kept noticing that there was a white discharge along the rocks of the river, so we sued them as well. What we try to get in what we get obtained from a lawsuit is compliance with the permit, a mitigation or penalty rather than go to the U.S. Treasury that gets reinvested in a third-party water quality mitigation project, and then our attorney's fees paid to our outside attorneys. We actually don't make a penny on this on this litigation. This is St. Gobain in the foreground. It's a glass recycling plant, and we sued them for high levels of suspended solids and zinc discharges. One of the biggest polluters we've stopped is Ace Galvanizing in the South Park. Zinc is toxic to aquatic organisms at 90 micrograms per liter, and they were discharging at 130,000 micrograms per liter in a little creek called Ham Creek that discharges into the Duwamish River. And, you know, galvanizing is basically they take raw steel and treat it. They dip it in a tank to galvanize it, and it prevents it from rusting. And they've actually built all sorts of big structural steel parts for the Port of Seattle, for the Experience Music Project, and even Shilshul Bay Marina. And they've done, since our litigation, they've actually brought their discharges down to from 130,000 to about 200 now. And this is a bad picture, but there's a series of dark tanks in there, and they've actually installed a treatment system to that's effective in taking zinc down to 200. Still doesn't comply with water quality standards, which is 90, but it's we're reaching the edge of technology. Another site that we sued that we just settled this week is Tacoma Metals. It's a recycling facility that discharges to Commencement Bay, and we sued them for just, they're the, probably the most egregious discharger that we've seen I've seen in the past 9 years. But they have all sorts of metal, shredded metal, exposed to stormwater. And this is a soluble cutting oil that they use to cut the metal that's just going right to the storm drain that's between the two men. And we finally got a consent decree with them to actually stop the discharge. But it's been a really discouraging process. You know, and it's unfortunate because recycling is such an important part of what we need to do, but they're also tend to be the dirtiest sites and kind of the scrappiest people to work with. The other thing that we do, here's the last photo from that. The other thing that we do is that we're on the water. We patrol regularly looking for illegal sources of pollution. We go out usually 60 to 70 times a year, both on the Soundkeeper boat and on kayak patrols, and we bring out about over 300 people. We train them to look for, here's one of the groups that we trained a couple years ago. We train volunteers to detect and document and report illegal pollution, and we have a pollution hotline call, so we field calls from citizens that we've trained, about 100 a year. We patrol the Wamish River, which is shown here, some of the interesting remnants. That's a barge that sank with a truck on it. It's actually gone now. We also patrol Elliott Bay, Lake Union, and the Ship Canal. We were out with one of our funding comes from, about half of it comes from private foundations that support environmental work, like the Bullitt Foundation, Northwest Fund for the Environment, Russell Family Foundation. And we had our biggest funder out on patrol and their staff, and we went by the Duwamish Shipyard, and we saw this discolored orange water in the pouring from this graving dock, where they can actually open the door, let ships in and close it, and then sandblast them. But unfortunately, though, they never treated the water, and it was always coming out orange. So we were on patrol one day with our biggest funders, and we saw this, and we were able to sample it and send the photos to the Department of Ecology, and they were issued a $3,000 fine, which is, it was good, but it was a small fine. On patrol, this is on the lake, this is a Foss shipyard on the Ship Canal, and this is how a dry dock looks, with good tarping, and they usually do a really good job, but we look for things like, unfortunately on this day, they were sandblasting and some of it was getting in the water. Again, some of these ships have tributyl tin on them. If they're a foreign ship, they also have zinc or copper again. Here's untarped sandblasting at North Lake Shipyard on Lake Union. When we see an event like this, we usually call the Department of Ecology and report it. Again, here's the paint chip sort of flowing into the water. Here's somebody painting the side of a ship by hand, which is illegal, and you can kind of see drips sort of running down the side of the hull. Sometimes we find this is an illegal boatyard operation. They actually didn't have a permit, and they're sandblasting without tarping. Again, this is on the ship canal. We just happened to be going by. And somebody also said they had a lot of worker safety violations going on here, too. Sometimes we see illegal boatyard operations. Like this is a floating dock, and there's a guy kind of in a moon suit, and they were basically sanding the hull of this fiberglass boat from the waterline up without a boatyard permit, without any of the proper tarping or containment things. So we report illegal boatyard operations, and sometimes this is a mallard at, down by our office on the ship canal, and watching blue paint chips going by. And unfortunately, we got out in the boat to see where the blue paint chips were coming, and then we realized that most of the hulls of the fishing fleet that was in being worked on, they all had blue hulls. With so it was impossible to find where it was coming from. And we even report illegal air pollution. This is down on Elliott Bay, where they load grain onto ships to go to foreign ports. So we report those to the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency. Finally, we monitor. This is sewage from West. This is the West Point sewage treatment plant off to the left, that where most of Seattle's sewage is treated. We monitor the records to make sure that they're in compliance. We are also following the combined sewer overflow situation, which I'm not sure if all of you are familiar, but most of, because of the historic way the Seattle was piped, both sanitary sewage and stormwater all go into the same pipes and go to Metro to be treated. And when the system gets overwhelmed, then the sewage is pumped into, it's not being overwhelmed in this photo, but it's actually being pumped into Puget Sound at various pipes because it can't handle the volume. So, you know, the good news is that some of the stormwater from the city of Seattle streets are being treated. The bad news is that hundreds of millions of gallons of raw sewage that when it rains too much here are actually being discharged into Puget Sound. And this is at my marina, head of my dock, and I actually have a photo, which I couldn't find, of this pumping out raw sewage just in a really big rainstorm. So I think a lot of people don't know that. We also monitor recreational boater waste and monitoring fueling operations. This is on the west waterway of the Duwamish River. It's a fuel barge fueling a container ship. And we also monitor and help recreational boaters with fueling techniques so they don't spill. And we report a lot of fuel sheens. And here's we were involved a little bit in the Point Wells oil spill cleanup. So some of the other things, so that's kind of what we see on the water and sort of from the enforcement side of things. But like I said earlier, we also work in partnership with people that want to do the right thing and businesses that want to do the right thing. And most recently, we started a clean marina program along with the Northwest Marine Trade Association and Sea Grant. And it's a voluntary program for marinas to kind of go through and assess their hazardous waste management and better educate their tenants about, you know, here's where you can deposit your old oil or antifreeze. You know, if you're washing your boat, don't use soap or just use a few drops. Don't discharge your holding tank into the sound or to the lake. So there's a lot of education about oil spills, safe fueling practices like using an oil absorbent pad in case the fuel blips over the top. There's a lot of education about hazardous waste disposal, as well as this is a holding tank pump out vessel that will actually drive to your boat and pump out the waste from your boat. To date, 33 marinas have been certified. This is one of our board members at Stinson Marina with Ron Sims and Mayor Greg Nichols receiving the certification. We also are big on, here's the Soundkeeper garbage scow. We also do an annual cleanup of Lake Union, and it's really a symbolic cleanup of garbage and trash because really, literally, Lake Union should be a Superfund cleanup site, the sediments. But because there's no freshwater sediment criteria that were ever developed by the Department of Ecology, it's sort of languishing. So, but we do people always want to know, well, what book can we do? And picking up tires and garbage around the lake really helps people get involved and engaged and on the water. We have about 200 volunteers every year that scour the lake. We also do a lot of storm drain stenciling with different businesses and civic groups that want to do something, as well as we've done some water quality monitoring. We tested stormwater runoff from the 520 bridge and discovered zinc and copper levels. It wasn't scientific. We called it sort of media-based sampling, where we had like three samples that indicated that there were exceedances of water quality standards for copper and zinc. But here we are actually collecting those samples. We later discovered that part of the source of the zinc is that the drain pipes are actually galvanized, so you have to kind of watch your results on that. And then this is a storm drain near Boeing on the Duwamish River that runs muddy when it's bright sunny day and it hasn't rained for weeks on end. And unfortunately, the lab screwed up our results on this, so we don't know what was in it. And no one seems to know. We keep giving them GPS coordinates, and no one seems to actually know where this comes from and why it's running. But those are some of the frustrations. We've also partnered with the Puget Sound Restoration. This is in Raves Lagoon in Vashon Island. There are some remnant populations of the native Olympia oysters, which are little tiny oyster that were literally almost wiped out a lot from pulp and paper mills over and the discharge. And they're trying to find remnant populations and then reseeding them, keeping the genetics of the local population. So what they did here is they actually spread, I think it's called spat, so that it's the actual larvae would have something to attach to. And the last summer they counted 100 new oysters there. So that's another project we've been involved in. And then one of the most exciting partnerships that we did is with the Northwest Marine Trade Association to deal with one of the things that we discovered is we'd had a significant number of legal victories that said we've got to reduce the amount of copper coming off of industrial sites to in the 14 to 20 micrograms per liter face range. And we realized that we didn't really know whether any stormwater treatment technologies could actually reduce metals significantly. So we partnered with marine trade associations and three boatyards to test three technologies. This is the water tectonics. This is just they were setting it up. But it's an electrocoagulation system where they actually put an electrical charge that makes the metals stick together and then they precipitate out. It actually didn't work very well at this site, but we also tried ion exchange, which is a resin-based media, and then the cheapest one actually was a filtration system using different medias. But it was really great after doing all this litigation to actually sit down and look at a technological solution to some of the things. We also do lots of beach cleanups here at Golden Gardens. Believe it or not, one of the big issues at Golden Gardens is all the fires and the charcoal on the beach. So here we are sifting the sand to get the charcoal out. Anyway, and here's some more restoration and so on. So that's basically what we do. There's a new effort that the governor started called the Puget Sound Partnership, which is, I think, the third iteration of a government agency that's trying to protect Puget Sound. They're coming out with their action agenda on November 6th. They waited till after the election to put together their plan to save Puget Sound. And if any of you are interested, you can go to the Puget Sound Action Team's website, and there's going to be a public comment period on this. But to me, and from what we're seeing, there's some actually good, innovative ideas that are kind of groundbreaking, and they're going to need, the politicians that are running this are going to need the backbone from you and I to be able to implement this agenda. So if you're interested in how to get involved, I would go to the website. And that with that, I'd take any questions.
Questions?
I'll put you all to sleep. Yeah.
You said that there are two types of pollution permits in Washington State. You said the type one was for factory industry. Mm-hmm. Is that 900 cap? Is that just happen to be there?
That's how many there are. Is 900 sewage treatment plants and then point source manufacturing facilities, and then there's about 5,000 covered under the stormwater permits. But the most interesting thing about that is Ecology estimates that there's actually 16,000 unpermitted stormwater dischargers, and they've known that since 1995, but they haven't had the resources to go out and find these people. And we've been slowly having an unpermitted discharger program. We've been worked with law students here at the University of Washington and now at Seattle University to go out and find these. And I figure, you know, if we can do it and students can fit it into their day while they're going to law school, why can't the Department of Ecology? But that's another story. So, yes?
Sue, you mentioned Tribunal 10 on foreign ships. Is it still allowed, are ships that are longer than 25 meters in the United States still allowed to use Tribunal 10 in paints, or is there a total ban now?
There is a ban, except, I believe, I think there's a total ban, actually. And tributyl 10 is very, very toxic. They've done studies in Salmon Bay, which is by Fisherman's Terminal and the Ballard Bridge, and essentially nothing lives in the sediment there because of tributyl 10 contamination. Debbie, I'm sorry, I missed you back there. I'm sorry. I'm not Debbie, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
The question I have is, for instance, with the Clean Marina Program, which is a voluntary program, mm-hmm. that gives marina certification, is there any, who does the follow-up? Once a marina gets the certifications, is there any monitoring that's done, and if so, by who? Because it seems like a lot of programs are funded to set them up, but there's no funding for monitoring, which is an important piece.
Absolutely. There is a periodic recertification, and I don't actually work in that program. I'm not sure if it's 2 years or 3 years. And we based the program so we wouldn't spend 5 years debating what a clean marina was, based on the EnviroStar program at King County and a number of other counties developed, which is a protocol for reducing and managing hazardous waste. There's a lot more that could be in the clean marina program, but we work with the Northwest Marine Trade Association and Sea Grant, Department of Ecology, and a number of other partners on this. And the idea is to get them in and then keep bumping up the standards and reassessing. But you're right, that's the challenge with voluntary programs. And getting people to sign up, too, is really hard. I think you had a question.
Do you always start with litigation, or do you ever contact the polluter directly to see if they'll do anything voluntarily?
Maybe you should repeat the question.
Oh, yeah. The question was, do we ever contact some facility before we sue them to see if they'll voluntarily do it? No. We don't. The Clean Water Act you have to send a 60-day notice of intent to sue. So the theory being that if you can clean up, come into compliance in 60 days, there's no reason for the actual lawsuit. So we file a 60-day notice, and sometimes we find that they are in compliance, that the Department of Ecology's records were incomplete, and we go away. Mostly the issues can't be resolved in that time. And we do this for a couple of reasons, and we get this question in every settlement meeting we have. If you just had called us, you know, we would have done something. Well, you know, people don't act unless there's, you know, sort of something spurring them on. to act. And even after we've filed the 60-day notice and a complaint, sometimes these things will drag on for years and years and years. And so with really it's essentially me and an attorney doing these cases, it's just most efficient for us to file the 60-day notice and go ahead. We've tried with unpermitted discharges, sending them a nice letter saying, you should have a permit, here's the booklet, here's the application form, here's who you should call. Zero people. We tried with 150, zero people did it. So we're somewhat cynical and kind of, you know, our goal is to do something the quickest and fastest for Puget Sound, and it's just, you know, you get people's attention when you get a notice of intent to sue. It's a harsh, but in the end, I maybe only regret not calling maybe two of the over 120 facilities at least. But I think they're big stakes, so. Who else? Yes.
So you're talking about how you are enforcing all this legislation. Do you ever do anything to try to affect it, to try to make it more in line with what you're trying to accomplish?
Yeah, we also have work in the state legislature. We don't have the resources to work federally, but we've been involved in a lot of legislation. Because we've been successful in making stormwater, regulating stormwater more and more, we're expecting backlash legislations from cities and counties and some industries, for example, this January, that would you know, basically tie Department of Ecology's hands and limit what they could do under the permit. So we are mostly playing defense in the legislature at this point, but we are there because that is part of our successes has brought some backlash. So.
How many people work for your organization? What's their background?
There are, let's see, six of us now, and our backgrounds vary. Chris Wilkie, who's the head of our pollution prevention team who works on Clean Marina, he's a graduate of Cornish and was a musician. And Paul, who does our boat, is one of our boat skippers in addition to me, is retired industrial designer and Coast Guard member. He's in his mid-70s and works part-time for us. And then we have a couple of recent graduate from Lewis and Clark Law School and a recent graduate from the Bainbridge Institute, just got an MBA in sustainable business. And then our office manager, you know, ran family businesses. So we're just kind of and our board of directors is 17 members of the business community, seafood business, documentary filmmakers, pretty, you know, Sea Bear products, former U.S. attorney. So we're kind of a broad base, but we share in common our passion for Puget Sound, and we have between us a lot of boats. So we're on the water a lot. Yeah, we're back there.
What sort of training do you have your volunteers do to help in?
We do a quarterly training where we spend like an hour in the classroom with them and then take them out actually on the patrol boat and look at different sites. And then we have them go out with Paul on a kayak patrol of Lake Union, the ship canal, and then another patrol on the Soundkeeper boat on the Duwamish River. So that's the training that we provide. You know, we don't hear that much back from a lot of the people that are trained, but occasionally we do. The real fact here is that most of the pipes and the discharges are deep, so even at a low or a minus tide, you can't see what's coming. I think if we could see what was running into Puget Sound, we'd all be. And there was a sign there that said, you know, this is coming from, you know, Jublo's auto wrecking, you know, that there would be a difference in our perceptions. But right now, it's all kind of below the surface. So. Yeah?
What kind of consequences are there for a defendant in a lawsuit?
Can you repeat your question?
What kind of consequences are there for a defendant in a lawsuit? Well, they have to pay our attorney's fees. They have to come into compliance with the permit language. And they have to pay their attorney's fees. They have to pay a penalty, which the fine under the Clean Water Act is $37,500 per day, per parameter. So most of these cases are, you know, if you actually were paying, the actual fine would be millions and millions of dollars. Our average penalty is maybe only $20,000 or $30,000 with a range of, you know, like 5 to 130. And they have to be under a court-ordered consent decree or a settlement agreement that we monitor for over usually 3 years. So it's costly, and it hopefully provides a deterrent. And as we target different business sectors, we also hope that the kind of the message gets out, you know, ripples through the recycling business or other businesses. So. Anybody? Oh, yes.
Can you mention the lack of freshwater sediment standards? Are there plans, Department of Ecology have plans or a timeline for developing those?
I actually don't know the answer to that. Right now, the water quality program at the Department of Ecology has a hiring freeze and is down like 20 to 25 staff people. So they're very in a world of hurt. And most of the people they've laid off or have positions that they haven't filled are on the ground stormwater inspectors and people who provide technical assistance. So, you know, no one willfully violates these permits. I mean, there's really, you know, maybe with one exception, you know, it fell through the cracks or people didn't understand it. You know, stormwater is sort of, you know, it's not like you're manufacturing something and there's a pipe coming out that's running off your yard, it's running off your, you know, your parking lot. So it's a, but yeah, I don't know if Ecology has gone down that track. Yes?
You mentioned that the Puget Sound Partnership is like the third or fourth iteration of government agencies that act cleaning up the sound. Do you have any sense of how, what the chances are that the Puget Sound Partnership is going to be successful in the previous groups? And do they have a lot of money to throw at this?
No, they. I mean, it's. I think it's about money, you know, to have to tackle a lot of the problems in Puget Sound. And there's a lot of people sort of lining up at the trough, getting ready to get their research project funded or their you know pilot project or whatever. But money is a really big issue, and it's going to be an issue in the legislature because really to implement this, they want to be able to provide incentives for new technology or low impact development, pilot studies, and so on. I don't know whether they're going to be any more successful than any other. I mean, I read recently the 1986 Puget Sound Management Plan, and it's not unlike the one that came out in 2007. You know, all the easy decisions, I think, about saving Puget Sound have been made. I mean, there's no, you know, it's really about, you know, all of us cutting back and then dealing with this infrastructure and the way we develop land, you know, that's going to control these pollutants. And it's a really big challenge. And I think I would like to think it's going to be successful, but we're going full on with our program. We're not going to wait in the wings to see.
Can you do anything with the wood canal? Is that part of it, or?
You know, we haven't done much with Hood Canal except directed some mitigation funding from lawsuits into some research there. There's not a lot of industrial sites there, not a lot of stormwater issues, and other groups work on septic systems. So we've kind of monitored that, but I think the only other thing we've looked at is like holding tank pump outs for recreational boaters and stuff, so not much there.
What about Vancouver, BC? Do you work with them at all? Do they have a program like this?
They just started, there's a Fraser River Keeper now that just started about a year ago. So they have a different set of laws, but we attempt to work together if there's something mutual to work on. But right now we're so, you know, we're each really swamped in our own worlds. Yes?
I have one last question about, do you see much potential for a lot of green jobs to come out of this pollution abatement? And can you hear much about that? procedure?
You know, I'm surprised that we don't hear more about it. I mean, I got so excited when we tested the stormwater treatment technology. It's, to me, you know, a lot of these, you know, the problem is that, like, zinc is everywhere. It's on our, it's just everywhere. But it kills salmon at 90, or aquatic organisms at 90 micrograms per liter. And basically, if you have a big parking lot and a lot of trucks coming through with big tires, there's zinc in tires, you're going to violate water quality standards. And I just think that, you know, the partnership and the governor are really missing an opportunity to create, you know, incubator businesses to find some solutions. Or is there an alternative product to zinc? Or is there something we can coat zinc with? I mean, I just think that could be a really, you know, I mean, Washington State is distinguished because of how green it is, and, you know, we're looked at as one of the most, you know, regulated in terms of protecting water quality states. But I also think we could go the next step and look for some solutions. I mean, we've talked with the boatyards about how can we phase out copper and bottom paints. You know, we successfully phased out tributyl tin. How do we do that? I think that's beyond me. But I think there's some tremendous opportunities that could generate a whole new line of, you know, people finding solutions.
Okay, well, thanks very much.
Thank you.